Welcome to Speaking in Maine on MPBN. I'm Gordon Fellis. Today, our program will visit Portland and the Cumberland Club for an installment of the Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series. The speaker is Peter Mills, Executive Director of the Maine Turnpike Authority. Appointed by Governor LePage, he was tasked with taking charge of the troubled agency. Mr. Mills will discuss its current status, the proposed East-West Highway, tolls, and other transportation issues facing the state. This program will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can access this and an archive of past Speaking in Maine programs, a service made possible by member support. Introducing the speaker is Penny Carson, president of the Cumberland Club.
I'm Penny Carson, and I'm the president of the Cumberland Club, and tonight we welcome as our speaker at the Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series, Peter Mills, Executive Director of the Turnpike Authority of Maine. Following the 2010 financial issues that led to the resignation of the head of the Maine Turnpike Authority, Governor Page appointed Skowhegan attorney Peter Mills to take charge of the troubled agency. Mr. Mills is a former state senator and a Republican gubernatorial candidate who was born in Farmington, Maine in 1943 and grew up in Gorham. He graduated cum laude from Harvard in 1965 and served 5 years in the U.S. Navy during the Vietnam War. In 1973, he graduated second in his class from the University of Maine Law School and spent 30 years practicing law. He also founded two economic development projects in central Maine and served the Maine legislature for 15 years. In 2006 and 2010, Mr. Mills made unsuccessful bids for the Republican gubernatorial nomination, losing first to Chandler Woodcock and finally to Paul LePage. Peter and his wife, Superior Court Justice Nancy Mills, have three adult daughters and three grandchildren. They live in a tree farm in Cornville with two English setters. Thank you very much, and let's welcome Peter Mills, please.
Well, I understand I'm tied to the microphone tonight, so it's a little constraining. And you have to put them in writing in order that I can repeat them, I think, and that they can be going out over the air. So it's a little bit artificial, but that's all right. We'll make do. I've spoken before, I think, in a context where I think some of you may have been present, so I'll try to vary this a little bit. I was at the Portland Chamber of Commerce the other day, and the Eggs and Issues presentation, and some of what I want to say tonight will overlap that presentation. But I always like to start by explaining that transportation policy is a little new for me. I never was on the Transportation Committee during the 16 years that I was in the legislature. I was on practically, every other committee that they could invent. But I had a few concerns about transportation all during the time that I was in public service. And I think a lot of it stemmed from reflecting back on my childhood. I remember when I was 14 years old, I had a great uncle who was 74 at the time. He had a huge antique store. He had three barns full of antiques up on Route 2 in Farmington on the Wilton Road. It was one of the largest antique collections in the United States, in the eastern part of the United States, I think. And he lost his license. He had a problem with alcohol, and he lost his license for a year. And he called up my dad and asked if young Peter, had his license yet. And there was no way on earth that my dad was going to give me my license to drive a car until I was probably 20. But in those days, as you may remember, some of you can, that you could get your license at age 15, and there was no requirement for driver's ed or anything of the kind. And so he reluctantly agreed to let me take my test when I was on June 3rd, 1958, when I turned 15. And I got the license, and I went up to live with my uncle for the summer. And I remember driving this 1953 Chevrolet Woody station wagon around, and we would pile it high every evening. He had a number of pickers all over central Maine, and he would buy huge quantities of antiques and bring them back to his barns, and then he would sell them in some cases trainloads of them into the West, into places like to dealers in Ohio, places like that where they didn't have as much supply of antiques as they do here. This is all a distraction from the main point which I want to make, and that is this. When we were filling up that Woody 1953 Chevrolet wagon, we were paying 21 cents a gallon for gas. And of that 21 cents, 7 cents, one-third of it, was going to the state of Maine in taxes. Another 4 cents was going to the federal government in taxes. So half of the cost of gasoline in the 1950s was going for taxes. Compare that with today. 30 cents is the state's gas tax. 18.4 is the federal, total of 48 cents roughly. And you're paying 10 times that much, almost, maybe 9 times that much anyway, for gas lately. What we've done, I oftentimes like to say this about my father, who was in the legislature in the 40s. If you asked him what it was that he did for work as a state legislator, I think he would have said, and his peers would have said, oh, our role in the mid part of the 20th century was to build the highway infrastructure that accommodated our society to the internal combustion engine. The highway department, the transportation department, and state government was far and away the largest department of state government. It was the biggest thing that the state did in those days. From about 1923, when they put a penny on the gas tax, on forward, and everything got paved, bridges got built, roads got straightened, roads got widened, ditched. I mean, many of us have lived through this. And then there was a major transformation, really, in about 1960. I picked 1965 as the year that Lyndon Johnson and his friends invented Medicare, Medicaid, and the Great Society, all the initiatives that we remember from in Portland in those days, model cities. Today, if you look at the state budget, the Department of Transportation is just as big as it ever was, even adjusting for inflation. But the Department of Human Services is 6 times larger, having been a dwarf in the 1940s and 50s. So the role, if you ask a modern legislator, if you ask me, what was I doing down there for 16 years, I will tell you. We were running the state's largest insurance company, Medicaid. Right. We were on the board of directors. And we were responsible for welfare, for human welfare, for human services. Transportation was a satellite mission. Well, the offshoot of all of that and the loss of gas tax revenue in proportion to the uses of the highway has resulted in a situation where we have built our parents and grandparents built a highway infrastructure that we no longer are willing to sustain. It is aging out dramatically on almost every front. We do not have enough tax revenue coming off the gas tax, certainly, or the property tax, which is the other major source, to sustain the roads and bridges that our parents and grandparents built for us. And it isn't so much that we can't, it's a matter of not having the will to do so. And it's something I've never quite understood. In 16 years being in the legislature, I can honestly say I never had a constituent come up to me and complain that the gas taxes were too high. I did have people say that the price of gas was highly problematic, which it is for people. But I never had anybody tell me, my God, 30 cents a gallon is too much to be paying for gas. And yet, within the confines of the state legislature, within the halls of the Capitol building, and again in Washington, in Congress, there is a widespread understanding that doing anything with the gas tax is almost like the third rail. No one has the courage to change it. The federal gas tax has been the same now since 1993. And it's not a percentage of the price. It is so many pennies per gallon. So it loses its value over time. There is this widespread fear among politicians, and I've never understood the genesis for it, that if you touch the gas tax, if you raise the gas tax, that people will hate you for it. And yet, I personally never felt that any pressure from my constituents on that score. Where does that leave us? I think both in Maine and in many other states, you're going to see tolling authorities come to the fore. There's this widespread notion that maybe we ought to be taxing cars and trucks on the basis of how much they actually use the facility, the highway. It starts, of course, with the cash tolling systems that we introduced in 1947 when the Maine Turnpike, which was the second turnpike in the United States. Pennsylvania was the first. We were the second. It started there, but with electronic tolling, with these little transponders that we're now selling for only $10. Stick that in your windshield. Give us your credit card for the use of it. And we keep track of what's going on and send you a bill, or bill your credit card from time to time for use. Is it fair? Probably not. Consider that when you burn a gallon of gasoline on the turnpike, you have donated 30 cents to the state and 18 cents to the federal government for a highway that they had nothing to do with. Tolls built the main turnpike. So the turnpike really, in its economic structure, is a mechanism for subsidizing state transportation policy. But that's true of all toll roads. And my sense of things is that we are beginning to see in America today sort of a three-layer cake of support for highway infrastructure. When you want to get from one city to another at 65 miles an hour, I think the day will come when practically all of those highways, including the interstate system that was built with Eisenhower highway money, remember, in 1956, as freeways. My sense is that in order to sustain that highway system, Congress will eventually have to allow the states to begin tolling those roads. If not to repair them, then for purposes of expansion. And right now, federal law says that if you want to add capacity to one of those freeways, a state does have the authority to put a tolling structure on those highways. For example, close to home here, if it becomes necessary, it isn't yet, but if it does become necessary to expand 295 from Portland up to, say, Brunswick, if the state decides to add a third lane, let's say, on either side, it is legal now under federal law to put tolls on to support that effort. It's not, however, federally appropriate, to put tolls on the road now to support its repair. It's not allowed. Well, anyway, I can foresee a situation where we have these larger highways, limited access highways in America that will be supported largely by tolls. And you have a second layer of highways like Route 2, Route 1, the non-limited access highways that will continue to be supported largely by gas taxes. And then you have what you have today, streets, county roads, local roads and streets that will be supported by the property tax pretty much as they are now. About 62% of all of our tolls at the turnpike, we collect about $106 million a year, a dollar at a time typically. 62% of it is electronic. My prediction is that will grow towards 70 or 80% in the next few years because of we've lowered the price of the transponder. We're going to make it a lot easier for people to sign up for Easy Pass. It is remarkable what sorts of information are collected as you pass through that toll booth. I don't think the public... We have rather interesting discussions sometimes with the Maine Civil Liberties Union about the information that we collect and keep As you pass through those gates, there's a light shield that you pass through that distinguishes one vehicle from another and distinguishes trailers from cars. There are devices in the pavement that count the number of axles. The newer ones that we're putting in will actually count the tires, so it'll know if your car has dual rear wheels on it or not, because there's an extra fare for that, extra charge for that. I'm sorry to impress you with all of this, but I'm not sure it's in my interest to do so, but I will tell you the truth. We take your video, not you, but your car's video picture on the front as you go through and again on the back, so we get both the front plate and the rear plate. But our accommodation with the Civil Liberties Union is that we will not take your picture. But if your spouse's divorce lawyer wants to know where your car was in a given moment in time, it's possible to figure that out quite readily. And then, of course, all of this data is collected. If you've got an E-ZPass transponder, the transponder actually talks to the antenna overhead. They have a little conversation about who you are. And then the data is collected in what they call a toll lane controller. It's a piece of software in a computer. And then all of that information is spit out periodically down into a large IBM computer. Not so large, by the way. Large in electronic capacity. Stands about this high, about this wide, like a small refrigerator. And inside that computer runs the turnpike. In almost every respect. And it has a twin, a complete duplicate up in Cumberland in a concrete bunker. And they talk to each other every 10 minutes, make sure they're up to speed with each other. And we have, of course, batteries to back it up and a couple of very large generators out at Exit 46 to make sure that it doesn't stop running. If you go through and you don't pay your toll, we take your license plate picture and we look it up and we send you a bill. In the mail. And if you don't pay the bill, eventually we will suspend your registration. And we just recently entered into reciprocity agreements with New Hampshire and Massachusetts so that we will be able to suspend each other's registrations. We're all in the E-ZPass family, so to speak. We have one rather, motorcycles sometimes only have one plate just on the back. And we have one very clever, sometimes during snowstorms, for example, snow will pile up on the bumper. And some of the more sophisticated people, the truckers and so on, know that they can't get their photographs, so they go through and we don't get the license plate photograph. This motorcyclist, however, rather cleverly, would go through and he put his hand down behind the license plate, proceed to give us the finger as he was passing through. Probably one of the most important, terminate this here, or at least my presentation in chief, in just a moment, but there's a couple of things I want to highlight. One of the things that the Turnpike is very good at is borrowing money. Because they've been in continuous existence since 1947, they've never failed to pay their bills. The legislature has, by and large, kept its hands off the toll revenue, and that is not true in other states. In Pennsylvania and in Massachusetts, the state governments have taken that revenue, and in the process destroyed the bond rating of the agency from which they took the money. The independence of the Turnpike and its extraordinarily favorable bond rating make it possible for us to borrow money on the short term for 1 or 2% right now in the current bond market, going up toward 3.5% for the longer term bonds. We're having a sale Monday, in case you're interested. $75 million plus some redemptions for another $80 million, probably $155 million altogether. It's going on sale Monday morning, and we're having what they call a retail order period, which means that it is a time in the sale that is set aside primarily for Maine people to buy the bonds. And there's a reason. For Maine people, they are tax-free both federally and state. The coupon revenue does not show up, does not need to be reported on either the state or federal return. So it is one of the ways in which, you know, as I was in the legislature, people were constantly complaining to me, legitimately, that people of means were often moving to Florida because, number one, the estate tax, number two, the income tax, and number three, strangely enough, the excise tax on motor vehicles, which seems to be an independent driver of people leaving the state. It's so annoying to people. But there is, but at least in regard to the income tax, you can shelter your main income by buying a from the Maine Municipal Bond Bank, the Maine, there are many sources of tax-free bonds. The Turnpike is one of them. But don't call the Turnpike for one of these. We can't sell them out of the, if I could, I'd sell them out of the window down there. But they come in $5,000 denominations, and they have to be bought through your broker. But we have made them available to, there was an ad in the Telegram where we advertised it. There's something like 20 brokerage houses. All of the ones that you're familiar with will have them available on Monday. So don't hesitate to call your broker even tomorrow and ask if you can get in on the thing. And don't be shocked or surprised if there's a shortage. They usually sell. They're very popular, and they sell out fairly rapidly, we find. All right, let me take some questions because I could. I've been to Turnpike School now for 11 months, and there's no end to what I will chat about if you allow me to drone on.
How should the state tax the use of electric cars?
They will pick it up on registration. We shouldn't forget that a lot of state transportation revenue is developed through the through registration fees. But it's, you know, that's one of the big reasons why people are saying, shouldn't we go to a user-based system, of which tolling is a good example. There are other schemes around. There are people who advocate that we should be looking at people's odometers, even if it's only once a year at registration time, and sending people a bill for the number of miles that they traveled, or billing them in the process of collecting their registrations. I don't know if that's terribly palatable to people, but it's one of the schemes that's been floated around. I don't think it has much political viability. But I think it's one of the reasons why you will see more and more highways converted to toll. That and the advent of electronics for collecting tolls, those trends, I think, will lend ourselves toward more and more toll collections as the means of supporting highway infrastructure. What is your view with respect to the proposed east-west highway? I've talked with Peter Vigio a number of times about this. His vision is that it would be a highway largely along existing gravel roads owned by land companies and paper companies from Callis in the east through Brownville Junction and then off to Coburn Gore. The legislature just last week directed the Department of Transportation to spend about $300,000 doing a market study to determine whether the building of such a freeway highway is feasible. What they're going to need to do is to go to Canadian shippers and say, how many of you are willing to spend $100 or $200 on a toll to go through the middle of Maine as opposed to going up the St. John River, which is where they're going now. I'm a little skeptical until I see the business analysis that says that there are people willing to pay that to do it. I question whether it will be feasible. And the reason I have some skepticism, and I've shared this with Peter Vigio, we already have a rail line that goes across the middle of Maine through Brownville Junction and Jackman. And it has very little freight business on it. And yet, if you go up north to Van Buren or any place along the St. John River and you look across the border, you will see the Canadian National Rail Line following the St. John River. And you will every day see a very lengthy freight train taking goods from, I think, transporting goods largely from the seaports of St. John and Canadian Maritimes, going up into Toronto and Ottawa and all those places, and Chicago even. For some reason, the Canadian National Railroad, following the St. John River, that arguably longer route, is apparently a more profitable way to deliver freight than it is to try to get through the belly of Maine and climb those hills and dodge those lakes. So if the rail industry hasn't figured out how to do it profitably, I don't understand how a tolled highway would work. But I'm open-minded. I think that this study, in order to be viable, needs to have people signing on the dotted line that they're willing to, these Canadians, that they're willing to ship by that means at a certain price. Because if there is that commitment, then the Turnpike could float bonds and could build it. We could. But we would need very solid, what they call an investment-grade business analysis, which is not easy to come by. Why is the gas price considerably higher on the Turnpike than on regular highways? And I am thoroughly disgusted that it is. I'm trapped by a lease agreement that was signed 5 years ago that expires in 2015. And I've already got in mind a whole new formula that will require. We cap the price that they can charge. The lease caps the price. The tenant, by the way, always charges the maximum price. As far as I can tell, they do. There are times when that maximum is actually down, either at or below the market. I have seen it. Mm-hmm. But there are other times when it's 20 and 25 cents higher. And it's a poke in the eye to the Turnpike. We're taking the grief, as we should probably, for that, what the public regards as gouging. So one of my goals, as I say to people, the longer I stay at the Turnpike, the longer my list of things to change. This is on the list, but I can't do anything about it until 2015. The question has to do with my predecessor and his behavior and why it was that the board, the seven-member Turnpike board during his tenure, wasn't more aware of what he was up to. The behavior that has become so notorious transpired over many years and largely involved very small amounts of money at any given time. And it's behavior of a person who was, after all, in charge of the institution. So one of the things that we've done, my question when I first came on board was, how do we stop, what could the Turnpike have done differently, the board, and what can we do in the future to make sure that no one, whether it be the CEO or anybody else, does this anymore? So I called some banker friends of mine. I said, what do you guys at the banks do? And they have bankers customarily have internal auditing departments where they have two or three or four people whose sole mission it is to test transactions for integrity throughout the institution. And although they get paid by the chief executive officer, I suppose, they report directly to the board. We had none of that at the Turnpike. I want to give credit. A couple of the people there actually did intervene because they knew some of what was going on, and there were some people who probably could be regarded as heroes in a sense because they did bring it to a halt. Much of what happened many years ago. There was very little of this that was recent. In any case, what we have done, and now this is in the law that governs the Turnpike, it says that we must maintain, and we do now maintain, a program of what we call compliance auditing. We thought it might be best if we hired auditors from outside the institution and not have them on payroll, have them come in periodically under an engagement letter that requires them to test transactions at random and by surprise and frequently, and to write a report. And the report goes directly not only to the board that hires me, but also to the 13 members of the Transportation Committee in the legislature. This was at their insistence, and I said, sure. Paper's cheap, and we live in a fishbowl. And so that's the level of oversight that we have now. We're trying to imitate savings banks, basically, or banking generally. And we should, because we are the backroom financial complexity of the Turnpike is easily the equivalent of most banks in Maine. This process of collecting $106 million in revenue, oftentimes, a dollar at a time, we have 140,000 automobile accounts and I don't know how many truck and freight accounts. I mean, it's a fairly large quasi-bank in many respects. And we have a $400 million worth of bonding outstanding right now that we service under a very complex bond indenture. It's been a real eye-opener for me. Anything else?
Yes, we did.
Right. The first thing I did when I got to the... They said, how much value does advertising have? Is this really evidence of...
Malfeasance.
Well, the first thing I did in March when I took the job was to cease advertising. I says, what are we competing against? Route 1? Why are we advertising on television for the use of the Turnpike? And we had a budget of several hundreds of thousands of dollars annually, and it does not exist anymore. I got rid of it, and you know what? We're doing just as much business as we did before. I mean, no, I don't know. I mean, I as a citizen, I resent it. I'll be candid with you, when I walk around Portland, and I'm here a lot now, and I see a bus or a car with a bumper sticker on it that says "Take me to mercy," I'm going, what? Why are hospitals advertising for an emergency room? Save the money, put it into health care or free care or something. But I don't know. Central Maine Power advertises. Don't ever touch a line ever. He's a neighbor of mine, the guy that says that, ever. No line is safe to touch ever. He lives up the road from me.
That was a lawsuit settlement.
It was?
That's why.
Well, no, it's an important safety message.
But that was the settlement.
Yeah, but now they've got him on the television doing all kinds of things. They couldn't get enough of it.
What can I tell you?
All right. How much income do we share with the Department of Transportation? This is a matter of great concern to the bond rating agencies because as I said earlier, other turnpike authorities in other states have had their revenue. Pennsylvania is notorious for this. The legislature has taken so much of the revenue off the highway, away from the highway, that it has put the bondholders in fear that the highway itself won't be maintained. So we, on the other hand, have had a very decent... All right, I got to tell you the story. In 1947, they borrowed money to build the original turnpike to Portland. Then in 1955, they extended it from Portland to Augusta. And then in 1956, they passed the Eisenhower Highway Bill, which said, well, the federal government will build these things for you for nothing, so why are you tolling your public? So that's how I-95 got built north of Augusta and how 295 got built as an alternative road. That having been said, Dave Stevens, who was a fabulous engineer from the 50s and 60s and 70s, ran the turnpike and got all the bonds paid by 1981. It was debt-free. He turned the keys over to the state government and said, not only is it debt-free, we have a bundle of money here that he'd saved. I mean, I forget what the account was, but it was millions of dollars. And in those days, we were getting, 18% interest on your bank account? He said, you can run this thing on the interest for a while. You can maintain it on the interest. What do you want me to do? What do you want to do with this turnpike? It's all done. And the legislature said, well, we kind of like those tolls. And made a decision in 1982 to sustain the tolls and the turnpike as it then existed, and did so with the idea that one quarter of all the toll revenue would be turned over to the Department of Transportation, which was the case for some years there. Then as the turnpike needed to widen itself back in the early 90s, a deal was struck that the state would take much less money in order to allow the turnpike to expand to six lanes south of Scarborough without having to raise tolls as much as they might have had to be raised if than otherwise. So this left us in a bit of a limbo. So last spring, when the legislature was hot to trot to write a bill that would reform everything that was wrong with the legislature in one bill. We called it the Omnibus Reform Bill. So I said, well, one of the things we ought to reform, this partnership that we have with DOT ought to be formalized. How much do you want from us every year? What are your expectations? Let's memorialize it in the statute. That way the bondholders will know what the rules are, and we will, and you will. So the statute that has been in place now since last June says that we owe them 5%, that the turnpike has an obligation to spend 5%, at least 5%, of its own revenue on what we call joint projects with the Department of Transportation, that they must have some connection to the turnpike, that is, that it be an access road or an interchange. We won't be spending it in Fort Kent. We'll be spending it in somewhere in southern Maine, but it has to have some sort of benefit to the turnpike itself. And the other stipulation is that the turnpike board has to agree, and DOT has to agree. So it's a partnership. And we've had that relationship for a number of years already, but now it's formalized in the law. And the bond rating agencies looked at it and said, good, you're not going to turn into Pennsylvania or Massachusetts. Last week, Standard & Poor's gave us an increase in our bond rating just in preparation for this sale. So it worked. I'm very happy with the relationship that we have with the DOT. We're in constant discussion with them about various needs. The busiest, to give you a quick example, the busiest highway in the state, Saco to Portland, six lanes. When you drive down, I drove south the other day just to drive to Saco at about 4 o'clock in the afternoon, 4:30, and I'm looking to my left and my right, and I'm saying, how was this ever four lanes? I mean, at commuter hour, it's packed, it's moving, but it's like Los Angeles down there. Well, something like Los Angeles. But, you know, right now, the people of Saco have come to us and said, we need another interchange. We need help. Everything to the west of the turnpike is growing by leaps and bounds. Gorham is saying, they've already got a bypass of sorts, but they need, you know, how are people, can't get in on Route 114 and 25. All of the people that live year-round on Sebago Lake, Long Lake, they want to get to work by 8:30. The biggest challenge of all, and I need to mention this, is the Piscataqua River. It probably has been a big challenge ever since since people started settling up here 400 years ago. But we've got three bridges across that river. One of them is being reconstructed. The second one is weight limited. And the third one, the high level bridge, is going to need a whole new surface, a new deck in 15 years at an enormous cost. We share responsibility for that, those structures, with New Hampshire. New Hampshire insisted that we repair the Memorial Bridge, which is really nothing but a city street between Kittery and Portsmouth. That one's being rebuilt. How much interest do you think they have in repairing the high-level bridge in 15 years? Or even the Sarah Long Bridge, which is, for those of you who remember, the 10-cent bridge we used to pay when we came into Maine on Route 1. They're now negotiating with us because they want the Sarah Long Bridge rebuilt with the abutments removed so that they can service the seaport in Newington, which is not a main seaport. We have nothing on the north side of the river except houses. The south side of the river is the only seaport in New Hampshire. And they're saying, well, we have to do that, otherwise Portland will take all the business. So this is not a, yeah? And you said, and we say to them, that's an argument? Why we should contribute another $50 million to improve this bridge. There's a huge need to follow this because probably the biggest controversy in transportation circles right now is how we're going to work out our relationship with New Hampshire over the next to plan for the future maintenance and rebuilding of these three bridges. And don't take it lightly. If you are headed south back home on Sunday afternoons in August or in on Labor Day, the people in Boston, how many of them are there who want to make an appointment to go across that bridge at 4 o'clock in the afternoon to get the kids in bed by 8? The whole world is there. And some people blame the York Toll Plaza for some of the backup, and it isn't any longer. We have 17 lanes there. Yes, it's slow, but we spoon-feed cars through, in many cases, so they can be parked waiting to get across the bridge. And it's not just the bridge. The bridge has got 6 lanes, but it's jammed up on those days. But when you get down into the New Hampshire side, you get into a complex geometry of highway systems with shopping malls off the highway and Portsmouth on the other side and lights and congestion, and it's not good. And our tourism industry depends on our ability to get people both in and out conveniently. This is a huge challenge. And even if all three of those bridges are in perfect working condition, the traffic congestion is growing every year, even during the recession, it seems to be growing. So I don't know what the answer is. One of the thoughts I had is that you build, this is a little extreme, but you could put the Downeaster doesn't go across down there. It goes up into Dover to get to Boston. But you could have a highway that goes from, say, Saco to Sanford, over into New Hampshire, crossing the river when it's nothing but a stream. And then my view is it ought to go to Worcester, because a lot of those people leaving Maine don't want to go to Boston. They don't want to go through that funnel. They want to get home to Hartford or Pennsylvania or New Jersey. And a lot of the trucks do not want to go to Boston. They're headed west and south. So I don't know. It's just a thought. I don't have any idea what it would cost to talk about an east-west highway. How about a highway just to get out of Maine? We're talking a very expensive proposition. But to duplicate that high-level bridge would be several $100 million. So that's not exact. And then if you duplicate the bridge and you put people down into that traffic mess in New Hampshire, you haven't solved the problem. There's one big transportation. I think Wiscasset's a problem. I think there are other problems in Maine. If there's one big one, this is it. And partly because of the complexities of interstate and negotiation. Oh. This is the issue about why there are some, in some cities, there's no tolling between interchanges, and in other cities there are. Lewiston, for example, you can travel from Auburn to Sabattis. There are 3 exits up there, right? Auburn, Lewiston, Sabattis. You can travel either way on those 3 and never pay a toll. True statement. They do, however, have to pay dearly in order to get to Augusta, $1.25. Or if they go south to Portland, they've got to pay $1.75 at the New Gloucester toll. Or even if they get off at Gray, they have to pay that. In Portland, we have these exit tolls. The dirty history is this. Years ago, there was a decision made to try to go to a 4-barrier system. The thought was that get rid of all the exit tolls. They're annoying. There are too many of them. Just go to 4 barriers. York, Scarborough, New Gloucester, Gardner. And we'll run the turnpike. Anytime you want to go a long distance on the turnpike, you'll pay a toll. But if you're going between exits, just trying to get around Portland, we won't charge you. That was the thesis. They got 3 of them built. Scarborough blew up when they had to get a wetland permit to build the barrier toll at Scarborough. And the people of Scarborough and some of the people in Portland and South Portland did not want it built, at least not in that location. And I think there was a political concern at that time about, well, we got to do the widening. That's so important. And there was so much political resistance to widening the turnpike that they didn't push, I'm told, didn't push as hard as they might have in order to build the Scarborough barrier. So they got the widening through, but the price we've paid is that we've got a mixed system, one that depends on three barriers plus an array of side tolls, which are, it's not a good system. A lot of it will come clean as you move to Easy Pass, particularly if we can introduce high-speed Easy Pass, which we plan to do in New Gloucester next year. And because the Easy Pass transponder, it records all this information when you get on. It also records when you get off. And so the Easy Pass transponder will charge you only for the miles that you use. And that's true now, by and large. There are other rules that come into play, but basically that's true. So it's almost always cheaper to use an electronic, not to pay the cash, but to get yourself a transponder and use that to run the pike. I think the day will come when electronic tolling will kind of supersede all of these toll booths sometime in the next 10 years, maybe, or 20 years. And we will be able to have a rational system, because the current system is not rational. But it is an accident of history, of political history. There. It's the best explanation I can give you. Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to Peter Mills, Executive Director of the Maine Turnpike Authority, on Speaking in Maine. He spoke recently in Portland before the Cumberland Club as part of the Joshua Chamberlain Lecture Series. If you missed part of the discussion or wish to share the program with a friend, it will be archived online at mpbn.net. There, look under the On Demand tab for Audio On Demand, where you can stream the programs online or download as podcasts, a service made possible by member support. Charles Beck is the executive producer of our program. For Speaking in Maine, I'm your producer and host, Gordon Fellis.